Good evening, James McKenna here with my Science Hour, May 29th, 2014. Quite a few topics to cover tonight. The main science topic, I will be talking again about climate change with an emphasis this week on rapid climate change done naturally. How can nature change what we call climate? And now, in just a quick kind of lecture on this topic. What is climate? Climate is really long-term weather. Now, back in the day, back a long time ago, maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago, scientists generally agreed, I didn't, of course I was not in that camp at all, but across the board, whether it was planetary science, whether it was astronomy, whether it was meteorology, whether it was biological evolution, which responded to climatic alterations, no matter what camp you were in, this overriding belief of what is known as uniformitarianism, it's a concept in which Earth changes over millions, hundreds of millions of years, and things happen very slowly. And that at the base of all of this, of course, was climate, that somehow Earth maintained that, for example, the dinosaurs lived in the same atmosphere that we live in. Oh, maybe it had a little more carbon dioxide, because, you know... which is strange because it was a fully forested, fern-forested planet at that time with a canopy of vapor where it was just like a huge greenhouse. Don't confuse that with the greenhouse effect. But literally, it was a canopy. Now, the ancients actually talk about this before the Noah's flood. They were surprised at the end of the flood that there was a rainbow. The only time you have a rainbow is when you have a clear, dry atmosphere. It's drying out, and you have a pocket of vapor over there in the distance, and the sun is basically behind you. It's an internal reflection in water droplets that form in a like in a mist, but it's in a relatively dry atmosphere. So it's a mist of water droplets that form into perfect little circles as they float in the air, basically, and then reflect through an internal prism-type reflection of light, and then it comes back at a specific angle, and you can have double and triple reflections. I've seen many times triple rainbows. So, at any rate... It is, of course, far more common to see a double rainbow. Many people have seen those, but at any rate, and then there's such a thing as it's a sun dog. It's kind of a reverse rainbow in which the reflection occurs in water or many times ice crystals up in the atmosphere, and it occurs out at an angle, a set angle away from the sun, kind of little rainbows out at a distance from the sun. But those effects were never visible, were never observed prior to the Noah's flood. And that's why the legend is passed on down that after the great flood, God put a rainbow in the sky to tell us when it stopped raining. And then it was said also that he would never destroy the earth with a flood again, but that the next time it would be by fire. if the folks down here got a little out of line again. Now, at any rate, by the way, I did like the movie Noah because it did emphasize the vast cities that existed on Earth prior to the Noah's flood. There was a lot of good factual information in that movie, the recent Noah movie with Russell Crowe. There were some things I didn't like, but this is not a movie review. Okay, back to climate change. Well, talk about climate change. Old Noah had his hands full of climate change. But on somewhat long-term weather is what I'm calling climate. How can this change rapidly? So at any rate, that's the main science topic. I'll be back to that in a minute. I'll try and be brief on these other topics. In the Money, an article occurred on Money News, basically talking about the upcoming social demise. It says, economists caution, prepare for massive wealth destruction in things that you should take steps now. And it says, 19 stocks you must have in your portfolio in 2014, and it's talking about the destruction, massive wealth of destruction. This is, by the way, in Money News, of the, I believe this is The Economist, and, no, Money News. It's the webpage, moneynews.com. Anyway, but, okay, so you got Donald Trump and Mark Faber and Robert Wiedemeyer and other, is it Wiedemeyer, I believe. Talking Peter Schiff, you know, and all of these guys talking about financial crisis. Get your money out of the bank now, etc. But my advice on how to survive the upcoming financial crunch, and I've said this before, you have to, I don't care who you are, if you're a college student, I don't care if you're grandma and grandpa, or you're somewhere in the middle trying to work a job, or your family, mom and dad both working, trying to make ends meet, or if you've already opted out and moved to a foreign country, or you've opted out and moved to someplace within the United States, just like heading out. And believe me, I talk to a lot of people. I mean, I talk to doctors and attorneys, and this country is shut down financially. It ain't going nowhere. People are just existing on what they have. Nobody's investing in anything unless it's some place to go to and ride out the upcoming financial disaster, which is, I mean, the United States is, you know, it's already done. It's a done deal. So how do you survive? What I tell people is don't necessarily go into a cave and shut the door. Live on many levels, but you, if you have not, say, used your survival gear, or if you're not water independent, then you have to become water independent. You have to become independent. And that amounts to living on many levels, but you have to change gears between levels. You have to be able, in this day and age, you have to be able to, in a moment's notice, shift down and move back to the cave age. I mean, literally. No facilities, no infrastructure, no toilet, no supermarket, no convenience store, nothing. No electricity at the house. I mean, you have to be prepared for that level, whether it's man-made, whether it's natural disaster of some kind from Earth or some outer space, something, you have to be prepared. And now some people are going, well, gee, maybe McCanny knows something about a date when this is going to happen. I always laugh. I always tell people, you know, if you had a date of when something was going to happen, what you'd probably do is wait up until the Friday before that and then quick run out to Walmart and get a bunch of canned goods. Bad idea. Bad planning. What you have to do is be comfortable with what you have to survive with. Maybe 6 months, might be a year, you know, it might be never, infrastructure may never come back. John Moore now talking about the imminent electromagnetic pulse, EMP, that some diabolical third world, second world country might perform against the United States. I would be more inclined to think that it's our own people ready to pull the switch here and shut down that electric grid. And that's, remember, the key, the absolute key to shutting down the United States is to pull the electric grid. And they'd love nothing more than to blame it on China or blame it on, you know, some crazy or some, you know, laundry list of who done it in government. But how do you prepare for this? Preparation is the same. Number one first thing you need is water. That's why I concentrate on water, water filters, all different types, personal water filters. And by the way, my little mini 1 liter water filter. It's also available in 2 liters, but I'm kind of figuring out that what's the point, because as long as you're there, you can keep filling the 1 liter container. It's much more easy to carry with you. And at any rate, but my new mini water filter my mini water filters are now on the sales page, and just go check it out. I'm not going to talk about it on this show. It's too much material to cover. So, but anyway, getting prepared, you first have to be water independent. That means filtering and storing water. You have to filter it, and then when you get done filtering it, you have to be able to store it. And that's the concept of the new mini filter, is that you also have some little storage containers with you, 1 liter storage containers. So you have three storage containers in which to store the water once you filter it. And they have locking caps, something that the old stainless steel one did not have. Now, I love that old mini stainless steel filter, and we don't sell it anymore. But the new one, well, there's good and bad with everything. So is something better? No, it's just different. But it's a very good new filter system with storage. Okay, so anyway, become water independent, become food independent. Make sure you can get good food, not the organic, the GMO, you know, Frankenstein. And always be careful when they say organic, it's probably still GMO, chemically treated, and who knows what's in that. So just organic doesn't cut it with me. It has to be organic, non-GMO. Okay, so at any rate, food, place to stay, you know, a place where you can go to, and many times being in a foreign country is a good idea, but then again, if things really go south, there's no guarantee that foreign countries are going to be any better than here. So I've become of the opinion that the American public should rise up now and simply go to Washington and put a chain link fence around it and call it a prison. I think that's the best thing we can do with Washington. Just change it into a prison, the new Guantanamo Bay of America. Okay, this occurred this week. A listener wrote in and had some interesting topics that he found on the internet, four topics. And the last one dealt with, let me just read these. In fact, I'll be talking about these in the main science topic tonight. But the first one deals with Arctic lava and volcanic action under the Antarctic. That's the South Polar ice cap. The second one deals with the ice loss in Antarctica. The third one deals with the Fukushima radiation found in a European study, that the hot particles are in the air filtration systems in Norway. So if you can imagine these particles getting all the way to Norway. And now let me explain what's going on here. These are dust particles that have picked up the radiation. Radiation loves to grab onto dust and water and other small particulates. Remember that most raindrops and rain and snow and atmospheric conditions contain a tremendous amount of dust that's swooped up into the atmosphere and basically goes around the globe. And this, the Fukushima radiation has been found in Norway in air filter systems. So you know it's all over the United States. And by the way, that's why I sell my pre-filter. The pre-filter filters out radiation before it goes into your nice, clean water filtration unit. But at any rate, that was the third topic that this listener sent in. And the fourth one, this is what I wanted to get to, Lynx Solar Wind. This is in livescience.com. It says, solar winds linked to increased lightning strikes. And there's a video of this pleasant little English accent chap talking about an empirical study they did noting that the solar wind is linked to lightning. And they say, well, gee, we don't know why this happens, but if we did, we might be able to predict earth weather or, you know, severe weather better, because lightning is typically associated with severe weather. And so obviously, I mean, we have the, this is what I call the creeping crud, where science, little piece by little piece, discovers my work and then goes, oh, isn't this a brilliant discovery? And then they come up with some hocus-pocus explanation for why solar wind would, in the standard scheme of things, why solar wind would somehow affect lightning. But remember, in the standard scheme of things, lightning is caused internally to clouds. So previous studies had related cosmic rays to lightning, saying that cosmic rays come down, penetrate a cloud, and when they ionize the internals of a cloud, that's when lightning happens. Well, it still comes back to the fact that if lightning and electrical energy are created within a cloud, it's going to discharge in the cloud. It's not going to come shooting out the top and the bottom. Okay, so back to this article on Live Science. I read the article, and it's obviously a guy trying to discover what I've been talking about for decades, that solar wind is intrinsically related to lightning. And what I do in my books, etc., is show how the processes work from the time the solar wind leaves the sun, builds up the solar capacitor, the earth is discharging the solar capacitor, we are involved in that discharge, how the, for example, the new moon works in this system, the new moon passing, on and on. But at any rate, this little simple article is a staff-written article, and I always love these staff writers, as they are kind of completely bobo, if you want to call it, just complete morons to the workings of science, but they can repeat what they're told. So at any rate, the listener, I wrote back and I said, why don't you put a blog note on there and say, you know, this professor, not using my name, has been studying this effect for, you know, decades, and then put a link to the webpage. So he does this. This is on Memorial Day, early in the morning on Memorial Day. Okay, he puts a blog note up, and it's just a simple note. And also along the very first blog that is there is a spam blog, advertisement for weight loss pills. Now, understand, this would be absolutely not allowed, a spam blog note from somebody advertising a link to a page that sells weight loss pills. And so this is on Live Science, a science page that's supposedly dealing with serious science. So the listener writes in, posts his blog about the professor in, you know, with my webpage studying this effect of solar wind and lightning for decades, etc. 9 hours later, it's deleted. The listener's blog note input had been deleted. But what was comical was that the blog note for advertising weight loss pills was still there. They went in and edited out mine. Any reference, the nice reference to me, was edited out. Now, remember, this was on Memorial Day. So, now let me explain how this works. It's kind of like Google searching. There are search engines out there continually searching, and my name is somewhere in the list. I don't know how high it is, but it's certainly there. And so, any reference to Jim McCanny or the webpage or a link to my webpage or anything related to me saying something respectable about me is going to be eliminated. Most of the time it's done much sooner. But mind you, so the automated search engines are out there searching, making sure that the internet is free of any notice about Jim McCanny. But also, when it comes to editing out that blog note, some person had to respond and go in there and take that out, which tells you two things. First of all, they got this information from an automated search. It's not like the, you know, there are people out there searching for all of this. It's an automated search. When my name comes up, some person responds to it in some NSA or CIA bunker where they cleanse the internet, and they have to go in. Now, mind you, they had to have the ability to go in as a authorized manager and remove my blog note, the one that was favorable to me, that the listener put in. So it's pretty amazing, but just to give you an idea, the level of fear that these people have over my message. And of course, when talking about the crux of the issue, whether it's climate, whether it's weather, whether it's the solar wind linking to lightning, is that we have vast amounts of energy that are available to us earthlings, and we can tap into that at any time, and we should have been for over 100 years tapping into that. Tesla had the towers built, and that's what he was doing. He was extracting energy from the atmosphere. He didn't know about the solar wind. He didn't know about the vertical electric field other than what he could measure on the ground. There were no airplanes. There were no satellites to get up there far enough where you could understand what the atmosphere was like. He didn't understand about the solar capacitor or the electric charge in the sun. All he knew is there was a vertical electric field, and my weather book describes how the Tesla towers work. But he knew enough that you could extract that energy and put it out on the grid, and people could basically power their lives with this. So at any rate, that's what they are deathly afraid of. The public waking up and understanding that climate change is a bunch of, as it's used to, as a political football, is a bunch of hot air. That the standard weather story that somehow light comes into our atmosphere and creates lightning and storm clouds and tornadoes and hurricanes, just absolutely fairy tale science. So at any rate, just a little story anecdote for the week. Now, I'm going to start the climate change discussion here by talking about this situation in Antarctica. And I found this comical. Many people wrote in with a link to these articles, but there was a woman who represented the global climate change political scenario, went down on a U.S. Coast Guard ice cutter and was going down to do a story on global warming, hoping to find all kinds of melting. Well, it turns out that this year, 2014, set a record for not the least amount of ice, for the most amount of ice ever detected in Antarctica. Now, remember a couple years ago, that was the Antarctic ice pack was melting, the Ross ice shelf was breaking off and breaking away. There were vast flotillas of icebergs that were floating up into the oceans, melting, but getting very far north into the shipping lanes, etc., etc., etc. And so the woman went down there to do a story on global warming or global climate change, and the Coast Guard icebreaker got stuck in the ice. They couldn't get out. So, I mean, it's just so ironic. But at any rate, the point is, this year, 2014, a record ice pack, the largest ice pack ever measured in history on Antarctica. Now, another article, and this is thank, once again, the listeners for sending things in, is, last week I talked about the ice sliding off of Antarctica, and that is because the land is warm. That's because only a few thousand years ago, the Antarctica was an island down in the south, what would have been the South Pacific. And so the South Indian Ocean is about where it would have been. But the after the pole shift, when Venus the comet came by, becoming the planet Venus, that shifted the Earth, and thus the polar cap began to form at Antarctica. And somebody might say, well, gee, where'd all the ice come from? What happens, it's a hydrological cycle. The water in the center part of the Earth, the equatorial and temperate regions, every time it rains, it cycles a bit northerly in the northern hemisphere and southerly in the southern hemisphere. So the ice caps at the poles are continually building up. And there's a great story about some World War II pilots that were flying a mission up in the Arctic region, the North Polar region, and they had some engine problems, something went wrong, so they all landed on the ice pack. Other planes went up eventually and saved them, got them, rescued them, and took them out. But the planes, their fighter planes, remained up there on the ice pack, just sitting there. So back in the, this was probably in the 90s, they put together an expedition. They knew exactly where those planes were, longitude and latitude, and so they put together a expedition to go back and find those airplanes. And they thought they'd come back and maybe there'd be a little snow on the wings or something like that. They get back to the exact spot where the planes were, and there's nothing there. Planes ain't there. And so they were kind of trying to figure out what's going on, so they start digging. And they find that the planes, I forget, I think they were like 40 feet under the ice pack. And this is like, this is growing like a foot per year, the ice pack up there. That's how much Antarctica is growing. And so over thousands of years after the Venus event, you can see that there are miles and miles of, and in fact, some of that buildup was probably very fast at first, so you might have had a mile or two of buildup initially within a year or two after the initial pole shift. But at any rate, a few fun facts there about Antarctica. But also the rivers of water, this is both in Greenland and in Antarctica, which harbor about 95% of the world's fresh water, is melting and running in vast under the ice pack, in vast rivers that go out to the ocean and just dump into the ocean. But nobody is trying to do anything with that huge freshwater reserve. Now, this is something that's extremely important because that water could be put in tankers and brought up to areas where we need water, and to green the American Southwest would be one place where it'd be very beneficial. But nobody's going to do that because, gee, the price of Coca-Cola and Nestle's bottled water would go down. By the way, another just side note here, a little fun fact about water, is that every year, 50 billion, that's with a B, as in boy, 50 billion of those little thin-walled plastic water containers, you know, anywhere from 12 ounces up to, you know, a liter or 2 liters even, that clear plastic, which is not recyclable, 50 billion of those every year are produced. So that's the market of bottled water. It's absolutely amazing. And that's once again why I tell people, please become water independent, and along with it, get yourself reusable containers. Stop buying those plastic bottles. Oh, it's just unbelievable. On my sales page, I have a picture that is from the British Virgin Islands. It's a little national park. It's a beach down there. Absolutely stunningly beautiful, except for the fact that it's covered. I'm not talking just kind of covered or a few of them here and there. I'm talking completely covered with thin plastic water bottles. These are dumped by cruise ships, and they're probably come all the way from the United States mainland, where they're washed into the ocean and finally make their way up onto the shore of one of the most pristine, lovely beaches in all of the Caribbean and all of the world, completely covered with those thin plastic bottles. They don't go away, and they're not going to go away for a long time. They're going to keep building up and accumulating. Okay, so at any rate, how on earth can climate change so fast? A couple of years ago, the Arctic ice cap was melting away. They gave it a projection of 50 years at most, and Antarctica would be completely dry land, mountainous dry land. In 2014, just a few short years later, all of a sudden the Antarctica has the biggest ice pack ever measured in history. This is rapid climate change. And of course now all the politicians are saying global climate change. They realize that the Earth is now cooling, so they couldn't say global warming anymore, so they climate change. So if it warms up again, voila, hey, it's due to the greenhouse effect. It's due to carbon monoxide emissions, and you have to pay. It's just one of the scams going on today. And tell people wise up and say, hey, I'm not paying $4 and something, whatever, for a gallon of gasoline. But the main point is, we don't even need gasoline. We never did. We don't need oil. We don't need natural gas. And we don't need coal. We don't need any of them. Never did. Never did at all. So anyway, let me start a little discussion on solar conditions. And this past week, I took a look around. We're having some sprinkled severe weather around the Western Hemisphere, let's put it that way. And tomorrow, actually, the 30th of May, we have a new moon passing. That's a condition in which the new moon passes out from directly between Earth and the Sun. The moon is, during the new moon phase, is blocking the solar wind, and Earth is somewhat in the sheltered, imagine like this, you're driving down a lake, just say it's wavy, and you're in a little boat. So what you do is you get about 50 or 100 yards behind a great big boat that's out on the lake, that's making a big wave, that's cutting through the waves, whatever they are, and creating a wave system that goes out. But you're behind that boat in a relatively calm area. That's somewhat similar to what the moon is doing, buffeting the solar wind, and basically Earth is sitting back there in the dead area, so to speak, of that comet tail, as the moon is acting as a comet, interacting with the solar wind. And so when that moon moves out of the way, all of a sudden, when that tail, when the Earth comes back into the full force of the solar wind, it comes rushing in for a 250,000 miles. It comes rushing in, and if it's intense enough and coupled with other activity, whether it be aligning planets or cometary activity or just a strong solar wind or changing solar wind, then that pulse can come in, hit the Earth's upper magnetosphere, upper ionosphere, and compress it. And that compression is what causes a chain reaction all the way down to the surface of the Earth. So Friday, given that we already have some serious storm activity brewing, we have a little hurricane already out in the Pacific working its way up along the Baja, but at any rate, these storms could all of a sudden be jarred into a severe state on Friday. And I believe you'll be able to see this if you look at the weather reporting. But at any rate, is that climate change? Well, yeah, it's the Earth responding to external conditions. And so our climate, our weather, and at this point, I think there's really kind of a vague veil between the concept of climate and weather. You could talk about long-term weather changes and patterns, or you could talk about short-term climate change, like with the Antarctic, where it was the lowest amount of ice in recorded history just a number of years ago. Now it's the most ice. And so obviously this is done on a yearly cycle, and every year can be different than the last. So what's the magical formula for climate? Well, it's really difficult to say, but it's intrinsically linked to current solar conditions. And so when I started talking about the sun in the new moon situation, the actuality is that the sun is at a very low ebb right now. If you look at solar conditions right at the sun, if you look at all of the factors, the KP index, you look at the solar wind, you look at the magnetic storm activity, if you look at the dynamic pressure of the solar wind, if you look at the how rapidly changing solar conditions are, none of the conditions of the solar wind are significant right now. And that's why one reason is because we're being blocked by the new moon. But Friday, that could change. But there again, the point, what is climate? Is it a one-year cycle? Is it a two-year cycle? Remember that in meteorology and standard astronomy, space science, planetary science, etc., climate was measured in millions of years. That's how long it took for things to change. And so when they started seeing and measuring temperature rises at airports, etc., and started to catalog these, it became somewhat of a fervor, kind of a religion. And a lot of bad science went under the bridge at that point. It was too easy for some guy with a PhD to stick a thermometer out the window, say, hey, temperature's a little warmer today, global warming, must be due to all you guys driving SUVs up and down the road. But more importantly for that scientist, he got a grant. He got funding. It put butter and bread on the table, not just bread, but along with butter. Pretty swell. You know, it sent the kids to college, you know, it kept the wife happy at home, to have, you know, all of these effects of, and if the case of a woman professor, it kept the husband happy at home, which is the case many times these days. But at any rate, the end result is that with the, oh, and this happened back in the 80s, this was already going on. I was already fighting global climate and the greenhouse effect back in the 80s. I gave a lecture to a couple university staffs, and these were general college staff, on the erroneous science that is behind the so-called greenhouse effect. And remember, that was the basis. But you remember that they stopped and they still don't talk about greenhouse effect because it's so patently false. It's a concept which just doesn't work. The greenhouse effect started on the planet Venus to try and explain the altered elevated high temperature of Venus. And then there was the exaggerated greenhouse effect, and then all kinds of other effects that would augment the greenhouse effect. But it was understood immediately by scientists who were real scientists, not the Carl Sagans of the world, but the real scientists, realized that the greenhouse effect didn't work. Many reasons, very theoretical reasons, from the concept that you cannot, the way this supposedly works, according to the diagrams, is the light came in, infrared light made it down to the base of the planet through the cloud tops, and then that heat was reflected back upwards, and then made the clouds warmer, and it was trapped. And so then that was the issue, that the clouds would trap, or the carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, or whatever the greenhouse gas was, would trap the heat and then reflect it back down to heat up the surface of the planet. But if you look at the process, the clouds then should be warmer than the planetary surface. And on Venus, it's just the opposite. The planetary surface is steaming hot like lead, and internally also. So the question is, with the greenhouse effect, how do you get the clouds to be warmer than the planetary surface? And if that's the case, how do you get that heat to go back down to the cooler planetary surface to heat it up. See, it's backwards. It doesn't make any sense. In a thermodynamic sense, it's like saying on a hot summer day, you want to chill your beer, so you go and you put your beer in the refrigerator, but you leave the door open because you want all of the heat to get out of your refrigerator. That's like what it's saying. That's what the scientists, the greenhouse scientists, are saying to you. You know, put your beer in the refrigerator and leave the door open so all of the extra heat in your refrigerator comes out. That's what they're trying to tell you in the greenhouse effect. Now, that's the dumbest thing. I don't know of anybody, even guys watching baseball and football, would accept that as science. But that's what they're trying to tell you. Rather humorous, but they got away with that for a long time, but then it became so patently false that they couldn't rely on the greenhouse effect. Because sooner or later, even the beer-swilling baseball and football watchers, armchair quarterbacks, would figure it out. So they had to come up with something else, and so that's where the term global climate, or warming, or the global warming term came from. And then it became obvious that the Earth was actually cooling, that the scientists had faked the data, and the overall trend was really a cooling trend. So then they invented climate change, and well, gee, that's just swell, because no matter what the climate does, it's going to be right. And they can charge you taxes and pass water restriction laws and et cetera. Couple that with weather control, blocking water from hitting California, forcing the farmers to use underground water that they're almost depleted now. A lot of people don't realize that California, with its drought, the farmers have been producing, they say, the same level of food, and I'll believe that because the grocery stores are still full of California vegetables and avocados or whatever else they grow out there, oranges. But they're using underground water, and when that runs out in the very near future, there's going to be a massive collapse of the food supply, because California produces just a boatload, just a very high percentage of the food that's consumed in the United States. But remember that the climate control, the climate management that was happening out in California was man-made. They produced high weather systems, high cells off the west coast of California, and the typical winter winds coming off the Pacific that would provide rain and moisture, that would snow up in the mountains and collect in the reservoirs up there, that didn't happen this year. And so it was literally man-made, and the water that did evaporate from the Pacific was wound up into cyclonic storms driven north all the way up to Alaska, just about the North Pole, and then it came bounding down across Alberta, Saskatchewan, into the United States, and dumped in the form of massive amounts of snow. And that's why the radiation, that's why I was telling you about Norway measuring Fukushima radiation, because guess what? We're between Norway and Japan in the trade winds. They're coming easterly from Japan across the Pacific. The water from the Pacific is drawn up into the cloud systems, and those rivers of water in the atmosphere are coming across into the United States and dumping, not only in the snow, but now when there's rain, that same water with the radiation is being dumped. And so slowly the United States is being poisoned from the Fukushima radiation spills. And that is not going to go away. They're not going to solve it. They don't have a way to solve it. It probably could have been addressed early in the disaster, but all of the politicians are afraid to say anything, afraid that maybe they will be somehow ridden with guilt, because they were in the loop when it all happened. And of course, there's some truth to that. They have justification for thinking that, because the whole administration of nuclear power around the world follows a simple assumption, and that is that there's no harm in it, that nothing will ever happen, that there's no derogatory or negative results that could ever come from nuclear energy, which is, of course, patently false. The more we burn nuclear fuel, the worse it's going to be down the road and for eternity. Because once those casks, and they will, once those casks start to open, I think we're going to see mutations, if the animals can live through it, we're going to see mutations like the Earth has never seen before. So anyway, back to the sun and the minimized solar conditions. We're supposedly at a solar maximum right about now. Some scientists say we have peaked and passed the solar maximum. And the way they determine that is, number one, the reversal of the solar magnetic field. Maybe 6 months ago, there was a lot of hoopla in all of the news media, and there were scientists going, the solar magnetic field is reversing and we're all going to die. And of course, there's nothing to that. In fact, when the solar magnetic field reverses, it goes down, it drops and drops and drops, it goes down to zero, and then it starts building up negative. So it's not like this big, massive magnetic field change. That's a complete misrepresentation of the facts. The fact is that when the solar magnetic field reverses, it's extremely difficult to tell because it's at zero. It's coming in from positive value of magnetic field to a negative field, but crossing through zero. So it's very difficult to tell when the solar magnetic field reverses. So why that amazing amount of misinformation was blasted around the internet, I'll never know. I can't really speak for why the misinformation crew chooses its topics for a gullible population. But at any rate, the issue is that the sun is changing on a constant basis, is changing daily. In fact, you could make a case for the fact that it's changing second to second, or even subsecond to subsecond. That's how fast the solar conditions are changing. And so I always use the example, if you were on the day side of Earth, as you cross into nighttime, the temperature is going to drop 20 degrees, typically. It might be a little more, it might be a little less, depending on where you are. But the point is that Earth gets rid of all of that heat that it had over the period of that day. It drops down, and so if you could block out the light as Earth comes around again, if you could block out the light from the sun, and the electrical energy that's coming from the sun that powers the weather systems, etc., if you could block that from Earth for the period of nighttime, and then quick cycle through daytime, and then start nighttime again, in a couple of days, in a couple of short days, you would be down in the absolute deep freeze on Earth, because the solar energy is simply not there. So you could, but because the Earth is spinning around. So what does that tell you? That tells you that Earth's climate is extremely dependent on constant input, and not just constant, but without any breaks of any kind. So the solar output also is a factor. The fact that the sun can vary, it can go up in energy, it can go down in energy. And that's why, once again, it's important for standard science, which is the monitored, homogenized, blended science that's handed off to you, it's important that they give you this concept that the sun is constant, that it's ever constant and non-changing. And that's simply not the case. They're still trying to use the model of the 1950s, the solar model, in which nothing changes. Okay, so anyway, I'm going to change gears here a little bit. And I'm going to go to what one might call the definition of climate. I'm going to pose a question. Is there such a thing as climate? In other words, if climate is something that changes rapidly. Now let's look at just the situation where Earth turns every 24 hours on its axis. We have a significant atmosphere. It's not the biggest in the solar system, but it's still enough to maintain a certain amount of the accumulated energy that occurs during the daytime of the solar light that comes in. That's part of the equation. But we lose a lot of the climate, so to speak, overnight. Now, if our Earth changes that much on a daily basis, I have to pose the question, is there such a thing really as climate? Because then what's going on is every day we renew our climate. We renew our weather pattern. We renew what is going on here. So I think the whole concept of climate is really a misnomer, because what we're dealing with really is long and short-term weather. Now, let me read the official definition of climate. It says, climate is a measure of the average pattern of variation in temperature, humidity, atmospheric pressure, wind, precipitation, atmospheric particle count, and other meteorological variables in a given region over a long period of time. Okay, just listen to what it says. In a given region over long periods of time. It says, climate is different from weather in that weather only describes the short-term conditions of these variations in a given region. Okay, so weather, they say, is short-term. Climate is long-term, and they're talking long. So let's go back to the dinosaurs. It's very clear that Earth had a climate then that was stable over, 65, or maybe, what was the reign of the dinosaurs? 100 million years possibly, so extremely long duration. And all of a sudden, whammo, one day, that was it. Goodbye, dinosaurs. They were gone. So at any rate, the concept of climate, yeah, there is climate, but even in those days, remember, the Earth had a very different atmospheric constituency. It was a lot of humidity. It was like a greenhouse, a vaporized greenhouse. And even before the time of Noah, they couldn't see out very well. The ability to see out into the heavens like we do now through our more rarefied, cleansed, thin atmosphere. And by the way, I was talking earlier, that's what allows us to see rainbows, is the fact that our atmosphere will dry out, that it will get dry in that fine vapor of water that creates the image of the rainbow, that reflected light in the fine water particles. That didn't occur in the heavy water-laden atmosphere of before. And by the way, the oxygen level was much higher, and I believe that's why people lived longer. They had a much higher oxygen content. Something that people don't talk about, we have consumed about half of the world's oxygen. The oxygen level today in the world is about one half of what it was in 1900. But anyway, back to this concept of climate. If the Earth, or back in the dinosaur days, when you went into nighttime, the temperature didn't drop. In fact, if you look at the conditions today, if you have heavy, overcast, cloudy night conditions, the temperature may not drop more than a degree or two. So back in the dinosaur days, you had a climate that was constant day and night. It didn't change. And that's like Venus. Venus's night side is the same as the day side, even though the nighttime side of Venus never sees the sun hardly at all. It rotates very slowly. So that climate, I would say that Venus has a climate. But Earth, right now, with our thinner atmosphere, changes rapidly on a daily basis. We drop into nighttime. What would happen if all of a sudden we came around from nighttime and the sun were dimmed or giving out a lower portion of energy or a greater portion of energy? Then our so-called climate is going to change. And this is what the global greenhouse effect people were hoping that, falsely hoping, that the greenhouse would explain that little bump every day, that little minuscule extra amount of energy that would be trapped when the Earth was on the daytime side and somehow would not be released when we went into nighttime. And, of course, it doesn't work. There are 80 reasons why the greenhouse effect doesn't work on Venus. And if it doesn't work on Venus, it certainly isn't going to work here because our carbon dioxide footprint is vastly less than on Venus. But at any rate, going back to this concept of long-term climate, with our thinner atmosphere now, Earth is very much a weather-driven planet, not a climate-driven. And so this whole idea of climate change is the norm. We depend by minute by minute, second by second from solar output and what's going on. We receive a lot of energy, heat energy, in the form of joule heating, it's called. It's the electrical currents passing by Earth. We receive a significant amount of heat. The El Nino effect in the Pacific Ocean, where the entire Pacific Ocean will heat up in a matter of hours, surface water 3 feet deep, is a joule heating where the energy comes down. I explain this in my weather book, that the joule heating is a result of energy, electrical energy, hitting the Pacific Ocean. In the Atlantic Ocean, it tends to form hurricanes, and that's the form of energy that we see in the Atlantic Ocean. In the Pacific, we also see hurricanes or typhoons, but the majority of that wet energy many times can come down in the form of electrical heating of the surface of the ocean. But at any rate, the concept of climate, long-term climate on Earth, is really a misnomer. And so that's something I'm going to personally attack, the Obamas and the Gores and the people that are trying to use climate change. It's a misnomer. Earth does not have a stable climate. We have too short of weather patterns even to allow a long-term climate to exist on Earth. It's fluctuating up and down and back and forth, and the polar Antarctic ice cap is a perfect example of that. A couple of years ago, at the minimal amount of ice in the ice cap, and now the maximum ever measured in a couple short years, fluctuating. Earth does not have climate, a solid climate. It's fluctuating. It depends locally on local solar conditions, both light and electrical conditions. And the situation is, the Russians, when I worked with them back in the mid-90s, they said that Earth and the solar system was passing through varying regions of the galaxy, and that even affected our climate. So I'm about out of time. This is a very interesting material. I hope you like it. And by the way, this show comes commercial-free. If you want to support the show, go to the web page, scroll down to the link to the secure web ordering page, and become water independent, read my books, etc. This is the website jmccsci.com. That's JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.